My name is Carol Malone, and I'm a trustee of the library and also the chairman of our Lectures and Exhibitions Committee. I'm delighted to see you all here this evening, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Susan Cheever, who's here to discuss her latest book, A Life of E.E. Cummings, which is her 11th work of nonfiction. Ms. Cheever needs no introduction here. In addition to her nonfiction works, her journalism teaching, she has 5 novels to her name, and her writing has received numerous awards. She's a New York Public Library Literary Lion, has been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, among others, and serves on the board of the Yaddo Corporation, the celebrated artist colony. And here at the library, we're especially grateful to her for the many occasions that she's spoken on our behalf, most recently at our new members' party in June. And some of you will remember the new insights into the mind and spirit of Louisa May Alcott that she discussed with us here in the fall of 2010. In her life of E.E. Cummings, Ms. Cheever makes accessible to us a character and the times of this highly outspoken and yet elusive poet. A few announcements. Our talk tonight is being recorded, so you'll go down in posterity if you ask a question. And I'd also remind you to silence your cell phones if you haven't already. And finally, books will be on sale outside of the members' room afterwards. Thank you very much, and I give you Susan Cheever.
Hi. So it's great to be here. This is one of the most amazing rooms in New York where we've all taken delicious naps and read the Post, which we don't let ourselves do at home, right? Speaking for myself. So as some of you may know, I like to start with a joke. So I'm going to start with an E.E. Cummings joke. E.E. Cummings said that his entire style was based on a joke that he heard at the Old Howard in Boston in 1920. And it was one vaudeville guy saying to the other, "Would you hit a lady with a baby?" And the other guy saying, "Nah, I'd hit her with a brick." And that, according to Cummings, is the essence of Cummings' style. And it is. That switching out of parts of speech actually is. So I'm just going to tell a story and not read, and then you can ask questions. The thing that surprised me the most or amazed me the most as I came to the end of this book was E.E. Cummings' faith in the benevolent harmony of the universe. This guy really thought that if you behaved yourself, dressed well, were generous and civilized and mannerly, that you would be taken care of. And there are a lot of stories that illustrate this. So one of them, which was my father's favorite story, my father was a friend of Estlin Cummings, as his friends called him, was a story about a New Year's Eve in, I would say, 1933, when E.E. Cummings and his very beautiful partner, Marion, she was a model, were invited to a very fancy New Year's Eve party up here. And they lived in Greenwich Village in Patchin Place in some squalor. And Cummings, of course, had gone to Harvard. He had 2 degrees from Harvard, and he had the kit. He had a white tie and tails. He had a collapsible top hat, which he had filched from the hasty pudding. And Marion, of course, had many gowns that she had modeled. So they were invited to this New Year's Eve party, but they had no money. And all they could find in the sofa cushions and on the floor of their apartment were 2 subway tokens. So they got dressed up to the nines, right? Marion in a Worth gown, Cummings in his white tie and tails and his collapsible top hat. And they came uptown with their 2 subway tokens. It was a freezing cold night, and they had no idea how they would get home. And did they worry about this? Not at all. They had a wonderful time at the party. They were, of course, glamorous, fabulous, witty, brilliant. Everybody thought they were great. And at about 1:30 in the morning, when the party broke up, they got into the elevator. I imagine everybody was a little tipsy. with a banker and his wife, and still no way to get home. They got into the elevator door shut, and the banker said to Cummings, "What a lovely top hat." And Cummings said, "What would you give to step on it?" And the banker said, $10. So he stepped on the top hat collapsed, and they went home in a taxi. And that's sort of how he lived his life. And, you know, I'm not really talking about the poems tonight. I'm talking about the life. And that's the thing that really stunned me about him, because it isn't so easy to live that way. He also, when my father was in the Army in World War II, Cummings wrote him a letter. The water is very far away. Cummings wrote him a letter, because Cummings had been in the Army on the Western Front, actually in World War I, and Cummings wrote my father a letter that had a $10 bill in it, and it said, "I, too, have slept with someone's boot in the corner of my smile." So that was how he took on the world. And the story I'm going to tell you tonight is a little more shocking than the ones I've warmed you up with. But it's very, very similar, I think. It's the story of Cummings and his daughter, Nancy. And it starts in 1919. Cummings is having an affair. He's living in Greenwich Village. You know, he went to Harvard. His father was a Harvard professor. His mother came over on the Mayflower. He had all that going on. He grew up a couple of blocks from Harvard Square, and he had these 2 degrees from Harvard. And when he graduated with his master's degree, he gave quite a shocking class day speech at Sanders Theater, which got people talking, in which he attacked Harvard. And then after he graduated, he decided that he didn't like Harvard and all the Puritanism that it stood for. And also the president of Harvard then, Abbott Lowell, was a really bad guy. So Cummings went to live in Greenwich Village, where nobody cared if you had come over on the Mayflower, and nobody cared where you went to college, and nobody cared anything but whether or not you were amusing or talented. And so he loved it there. So Greenwich Village in the 19-aughts and the 1920s was a pretty wild place. So it's not that unusual that Cummings was having an affair with his best friend's wife. And the best friend, Schofield Thayer, was also Cummings' patron. So Thayer was paying Cummings, and he was Cummings' friend, and Cummings and Elaine had fallen in love. Thayer knew about it, and he decided to go off to Vienna and be psychoanalyzed by Sigmund Freud, because he thought maybe that would cheer him up. At any rate, Elaine got pregnant, and Cummings and Elaine had Nancy in 1919, and they decided it would be easier if they pretended that Nancy was Thayer's child, because Elaine was married to Thayer. So they did. They named her Nancy Thayer, and they pretended she was Thayer's child. And then the first big surprise of this story happened, which is Cummings fell in love with his own child. He just loved her. He was just thrilled by this baby and then this toddler, et cetera, et cetera. So he persuaded Elaine to divorce Schofield Thayer and marry him, and she did. And then he adopted his own child. So he and Elaine and Nancy became this happy, conventional, unconventional couple. And they had a lovely time for a while. They lived in France. They lived in the Cummings place at Silver Lake, New Hampshire. They lived in Greenwich Village. Elaine had a ton of money, unlimited money. So that wasn't a problem. And everything was great until 1925, when Elaine fell in love with somebody else. And the guy she fell in love with, Frank McDermott, was a real son of a bitch. He was an Irish guy. He was running for Irish government, the Dáil. And he thought that poets were sissies, and the past was something you should never think about. And Elaine drank the Kool-Aid, right? I mean, she fell in love with him is another way to say it. And so Elaine started withdrawing Nancy from Cummings. McDermott, needless to say, didn't think much of Cummings. Cummings did everything he could to keep a hold on Nancy. He hired a lot of lawyers. He sued for visitation rights. He bought a gun. He threatened to kill McDermott. But by 1926, McDermott and Elaine had essentially abducted Nancy and taken her to live in Ireland, and Cummings didn't see his daughter for 20 years. Right. That's the bad part of the story. This is where the story really begins, is what I'm fond of saying. So Nancy, for her part, led this sort of princessy expat life. She had no idea. She thought Schofield father was her Thayer, Schofield Thayer was her father, maybe. She knew it was pretty. And she knew her mother had sort of been a friend of this poet E.E. Cummings, but it was all very vague, and nobody would tell her about it. So she went to school in Switzerland, and she studied at the Sorbonne, and she learned a lot of languages, and she spent as little time in Ireland as she possibly could. And she grew up to be brilliant and beautiful and very interested in poetry. And one of the weird things is she started writing poems, which are spookily like Cummings poems, almost as if the strangeness of punctuation in parts of speech is genetic. Anyway, so in 1941, Nancy realized that if she didn't get out of England, she would end up trapped for the duration of the war with her mother and stepfather. And she didn't want that. So she raced down to London and took the first boat she could get, which was the last passenger boat out of Southampton, and it was going to New York. So Nancy went to New York. So she's in New York, and she's looking for a job, and she doesn't know what to do, and the war is on. So she gets a job with a woman named Mrs. Willard Roosevelt, who's Theodore Roosevelt's daughter-in-law. And Mrs. Roosevelt is running something called Your Secretary, etc., which is a secretarial translation, any kind of service you might need. And Nancy, of course, is a brilliant translator, a brilliant secretary. She's very good at all this stuff. So Mrs. Roosevelt is happy to hire her, and she does very well, and Mrs. Roosevelt is an Anglophile and just comes to adore Nancy, who is, after all, beautiful and brilliant and wealthy and charming. And Mrs. Roosevelt has a son, Willard Roosevelt, who's a musician, and he's about to ship out in the American Navy, and he starts dropping by the office. And he starts dropping by the office more and more. And Nancy starts dropping by the Roosevelt house. And pretty soon, Nancy and Willard Roosevelt are in love, and they get married and have a child. So this is where the story really begins. So in 1946... the war is over, and it's very, very hot. It's one of those hot, hot summers, like we've just had such a cold, cold winter. So Mrs. Roosevelt, who doesn't have a lot of money, decides it would be nice to rent a house somewhere in the country where she, her granddaughter, her son, and her daughter-in-law could all go and spend a couple of months and cool off, maybe somewhere on a lake. So she calls her friend Willie James, who's the son of the philosopher William James, and she says to him, you know, do you know of any place that's not too expensive, but it's very cool, you know, not too far from New York, but far enough to be different, where there would be a house I could rent for me, Willard, Nancy, and the baby? And Willie James says, well, absolutely. There's a place right up the road from me in Silver Lake, New Hampshire, where I go every summer, and I'll rent it for you. So he does. So Cummings hears that his daughter and her baby and her husband are spending the summer right up the road from him in Silver Lake. And Silver Lake, not a big town, right? So, and Willie James tells him. Willie James knows that Cummings is Nancy's father. Mrs. Roosevelt doesn't know, Nancy doesn't know, Willard Roosevelt doesn't know. Cummings knows, Marion knows, and the Jameses know. So Cummings at first doesn't know what to do. He's paralyzed. And so in the end, he does what civilized people do when they don't know what to do. He invites Nancy for tea. Nancy, her husband, her baby, and Mrs. Roosevelt all come for tea on one hot afternoon. And they get there and they get out of the car and everybody steps back a little. And Cummings and Nancy walk into the house together. And Nancy senses something. She feels as if his voice is some kind of, she knows something is happening, but she doesn't know what it is. And, you know, later she writes about it, of course, and says it felt as if his voice was an echo. But she just isn't sure. But anyway, they become friends, Cummings and Nancy. What could be nicer, right? He's a poet. She likes poetry. And they sort of, you know, Nancy says, oh, you were in Greenwich Village when my mother was in Greenwich Village. And every time Nancy brings up the past with Cummings, he won't talk about it. So they all go back to New York at the end of the summer, and Cummings asks Nancy if he could paint her portrait. Cummings is also a very talented painter. So she says, sure. So she's living in a crummy little apartment in Long Island City with her husband and now two children. And her husband is back from the Navy and very depressed, can't get a job, he's a pianist. And two children is two children, and Long Island City is Long Island City. And so once a week, she goes to Greenwich Village to patch in place to this electrifying household where this charming man holds forth. And, you know, Dylan Thomas drops by, and all kinds of things happen, and drinks tea and sits for her portrait. And Cummings has a studio upstairs, and that's where they go to the third floor. And he's painting her, and they're talking away. And she comes to realize that these days when she goes to Patch in Place are really the highlight of her life. And it worries her. So she eventually decides that she can't go there anymore because she likes it too much. And it's keeping her from being the mother and the wife that she wants to be. But then she decides she'll just go one more time. Isn't that always how it is? So she goes to Patch in Place for the last time. And Marion isn't around, and she and Cummings go up to the studio, and she's hoping that he'll be able to finish the portrait. And he's got his brush, and he's painting away, and they're talking. And on this particular afternoon, she says to Cummings, you know, what about when you and my mother were in Greenwich Village, and da-da-da? And Cummings seems much more open than he has been in the past. And he starts talking about Elaine and how beautiful she was, and Nancy's aunt Alexis, who Cummings thinks had a crush on him. And they're laughing, and Nancy blurts out, you know, I think I'm falling in love with you. So Cummings puts down his brush. And he says, in the gentlest way he knows how, hasn't anyone told you I'm your father? So this is where the story really begins. Of course. So in the 14 years that Cummings lived after that, the thing that's so incredible to me is how hard both these people tried to be father and daughter to each other. They had both been, they never would have said this, this is our language, severely traumatized. Everybody lied to Nancy, right? Her mother, her stepfather, Cummings, everybody. And she understood that, and she was devastated. And Cummings, for his part, had come to some kind of painful peace with not having his daughter anymore. He felt that he was an old man. He was towards the end of his life. His career was, you know, finishing, and he just wasn't really ready for a whole new passionate relationship. And he said, you know, the very thing I would have killed for 25 years ago is now exhausting me, is now killing me. So he was exhausted and she was betrayed, but they didn't let it stop them, like the not having the money to get home from the New Year's Eve party. They played it out and they wrote each other these beautiful, beautiful letters, loving, fabulous letters about the past. You know, Cummings dredged up all the memories he had of Nancy as a 4 and 5 and 6 year old and wrote to her how wonderful she had been, how smart she had been. And she wrote back and she visited him in Silver Lake. And then she left Willard Roosevelt and married a guy who Cummings adored, Kevin Andrews. And they went to live in Greece, and Cummings went to visit them in Greece. But it's stunning to me, it's very moving to me, how they were able to reconcile in spite of the fact that they were both so damaged by what had happened. And they didn't hang on to that damage. They went forward. And if you think about this story and how it comes together, you know, the last boat from England, the weird job in New York, you know, your boss's son, falling in love with your boss's son, you know, the baby, the house in Silver Lake. It really does look as if there's some kind of benevolent magnetism in the world drawing these people together, these people who had been so forcefully separated. And I think that, that kind of friendly fate is very much true in Cummings' life. And I want to suggest to you that might also be true in yours. So that's the end of the story. Now you can ask questions. Yes. Till she was 6, 6 and a half, 7. She did. Well, she lived in a household where nobody ever talked about it. It is bizarre. Well, she wrote a bit. She tried to remember. I mean, that was one of the things she tried to do. But, you know, and she had some memory of his voice. But, you know, it's an awful story, that part of it. Yeah.
And how do you understand her personality and how it evolved? If she were here today, how would you experience her?
Well, I think Nancy was a lot like Cummings, sort of very charming and easy to irritate. You know, not so patient with the world. And Cummings, you know, a lot of his creative energy, I think, comes from anger. And I think that was also true of her. And it's also true of me. I mean, I'm a big fan of that source of creative energy. But, you know, I think she was very charming, very brilliant. And easy to irritate, I think, is the, you know, she never really forgave her mother, and she barely forgave her father. And I was very lucky because she didn't tell that story to anybody else. And I happened to find, through a series of machinations and devious connections, the person she had told it to. He's 90. And I happened to be able to get him to talk to me. So, yeah.
How did the rest of her life play out? Did she stay in New York?
She went back to London. She had two children with Kevin Andrews. So that was, she was married to Kevin Andrews. She stayed with him in Greece. He was a sort of Patrick Leigh-Fermor type. He had gone to Greece after Harvard and really never came back. And then she didn't want to bring the children up in a country that was run by a junta, so she took them all to London and lived out her life there, did a lot of yoga, wrote a memoir called Sharon's Daughter, as in Sharon the Boatman Who Ferries You Across the Styx, not a cheery title. And it's a very interesting memoir. It's very hard to, you know, Cummings is not just a poet. He also wrote two memoirs that were published as novels and was an astonishing painter and wrote a couple of plays. He was the playwright who followed Eugene O'Neill at the Provincetown Playhouse. And so one of his books, I, Me, which is his book about going to Russia in 1933, it's almost incomprehensible in the normal way we think of comprehensible. And Nancy's book is sort of like that. You know, you can mine it. But, yes, well, it's published by Featherstone Press or something like that. I mean, yeah, but yes, it's published. It's published. I don't think so. You know, you don't, I mean, I have piles and piles of books, and I don't know which are still in print and which aren't. No. Yeah. Hi.
The love poems, you know, nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands. To whom did he dedicate?
Well, it depends. This is Leon's question about Cummings' love poems. It depended. Different women inspired them. Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands. That's Elaine. Before she abducted Nancy, obviously. But Cummings, he has an interesting history with women because it's a history that isn't supposed to happen, which is to say he had a disastrous marriage to Elaine, a second disastrous marriage to a woman named Anne Barton, and then he found the right woman, Marion Morehouse, and that was that. And they never married, but they were together for 30 years, very happily. And there are a lot of poems to Marion as well. I mean, a lot of Cummings' most famous work was done when he was young. But I also think the poems he wrote at the end of his life are fabulous. Yeah. Well, Cummings, like many poets, had a lot of trouble making a living, and he didn't care. And he, for instance, in 1935, couldn't get a book published. Now, he had already been a very successful poet, right? But he couldn't get this book published, and he sent it out to 15 publishers, and they all rejected it. And so he borrowed $300 from his mother, published 1,000 copies of it, titled it No Thanks, and dedicated it to the 15 publishers who had turned it down. That was what he was like. Toward the end of his life, he was able to make a slightly better living by reading. He was a brilliant, brilliant reader. He used his voice as an instrument, and also lecturing. He was incredible at it. To my mind, the high point of his life, which is where I start the book, actually, is when, you know, he had turned his back on Harvard and said, you're all a bunch of Puritans, and da-da-da-da-da-da. And then 40 years later, Harvard invited him to come and give the Charles Eliot Norton lectures, which is pretty much the highest honor Harvard has to offer. And he didn't want to do it, and he did want to do it, and he did, you know, he went back and forth, but he finally decided to do it. And those lectures are just brilliant. It's in those lectures that he gets up, you know, it's an undergrad audience, and he says that he doesn't know how to give a lecture, and that he's nothing but an ignoramus, and that he worships at the shrine of progressive corporeal revelation. That would be strip clubs. And so... So he was a very good lecturer, and as I say, a brilliant reader. You can hear him reading. This is one of the wonderful things of our technological age. In fact, you can hear him giving the Norton lecture, and you can hear the students rapping on the windows trying to get in because it was more than standing room only. So you can hear this bang, bang, banging noise. But he started making money as a reader. And that really took a lot of the pressure off. And that's, you know, this is all in the book. I met Cummings. And the way I met him, we had this incredible life-changing night together. You'll have to read the book. And it was because he had come to read at the school where I was a student. So that helped, the reading. Yeah. Well, you know, there are four kinds of research. One is you go to the Houghton Library at Harvard, which is where all his papers are, and you sit there. There are 176 boxes. And you sit there, and you sit there, and you sit there, and you wait. And there's one great thing about the Houghton Library, which is an amazing place and open to anyone, by the way. On Friday at noon, they have a little tea party. And, you know, it's an astonishing array of people who spend all their time in the Houghton Library. But that's my least favorite kind of research. But I did it. And then there's the... That's primary research, primary source. Then I did a lot of secondary source research. I read and reread until they were falling apart the previous three biographies. And then also a lot of Cummings' letters had been published. All his letters to Pound had been published. And I was able, again, technology, to find things that I never would have found before. For instance, his sister wrote a little privately published book about their childhood. It would have taken a year for me to get that before. Now, boom. I mean, it's astonishing what you can... So there's that kind of research. And then I've forgotten what the third kind is. Whatever. The kind that I like the best is the kind where you go to the place and sit there. And actually, that's how the book started. I was teaching at the New School. And I used to have tea with somebody, and I'd walk across 10th Street, and I'd see Patch in Place. And you can walk right in. So I walked right in. And, you know, I would walk around Patch in Place thinking, oh, you know, Cummings, da-da-da-da. And then one day I put a letter through the mail slot of the house, and I became friends with the people who live in Cummings' house. And I went down, and I sat in the living room, and I went up to the study. I didn't know the Nancy story, of course. And I started reading the poetry. And that's how it started, that just going to the place. And just to tell another story about this kind of research, is this what you're asking? Well, Cummings's father died in a accident in 1926 where his car, an air-cooled Franklin, ash-framed 1926, H.H. Franklin was a big deal in those days, was cut in half by a locomotive at a railroad crossing in New Hampshire. They were on their way to Silver Lake. And I couldn't understand how that could happen. I mean, how could they not see the train coming? Trains don't sneak up on you. They're big. They're noisy. It wasn't at night. It was in the middle of the afternoon. I just didn't get it. So I studied everything I could about the H.H. Franklin car, and then I studied everything I could about the Boston and Maine Railroad. It was this particular spur of the railroad. It was the train's last run south, and it had been snowing a little bit, and they got out of the car, and Rebecca Cummings, Cummings' mother, was driving, and Edward Cummings was in the passenger seat, and I just couldn't, you know how these country railroad crossings look, I just couldn't understand how it could happen. And, you know, the more I read, the more baffled I got. So finally, I put my son and my dachshund in the car, and I drove up there, and I found it. No one else had found it. And the minute I saw the railroad crossing, I understood. And that's the kind of research moment that I like the best. It's flush with the road. 50 years have gone by, more than 50 years, lots of time has gone by, but also it comes into the road at an angle. So if you're driving, you've got a passenger here, and the train is there, so you can't see it. And of course, the Franklin was useless. I mean, they made windows with glass. Most automobile accidents in the 1920s, people bled to death. You know, and the car was made of wood. So it wasn't, you know, once the locomotive hit the car... So, I'm not sure I answered your question, but okay. Yeah.
Would you say that Cummings' work reflects this sort of the way I hear you describing it, sort of life and everything he's kind of taken? He just sort of went with everything, and it was upbeat and
right.
And I found that very dark, but now that I hear you talk, I mean, it's really very funny, too.
Exactly.
So I'm wondering
if it's
poetry.
Well, so let me say what The Enormous Room is first. So in World War I, Cummings went to drive ambulances with a special ambulance corps that had actually been established for Harvard graduates, the Norton Hargis Ambulance Corps, and he and his friend Slater Brown went to San Quentin and were driving, supposedly driving ambulances. There was no action there that particular summer. It was the Somme. It was the Western Front. It was within a few miles of where Wilfred Owen and Rupert Brooke and a lot of other people got killed, both before and after they were there. But Cummings and Brown, they were just cut-ups, you know, Cummings. And so they had learned French, so they didn't want to talk to their commander, Harry Anderson, who had been an auto mechanic, who they didn't think was very interesting. They would much rather talk with the French soldiers. So they started writing letters home about things they were learning from the French soldiers. The French troops were very demoralized. There had been a coup. Harry Anderson was a moron, you know. And so eventually they got arrested for being traitors. And also they were as obnoxious as people can be. I mean, at one point, Harry Anderson said something Cummings didn't like, and Cummings took a lungful of cigarette smoke and blew it in his commander's face. I mean, they were really, you know. So they got arrested, and Cummings and Brown ended up in this, actually they were taken much further west, which saved their lives, and they ended up in this former seminary where they were incarcerated for 3 months. And, you know, Cummings' his attitude was, oh my goodness, a jail, how delightful. I mean, it's really, you know, he wrote letters to his mother saying, I am having the time of my life. And, you know, he was sleeping on bug-ridden straw, not getting enough to eat, not enough water, you know, 40 men in one room, pissing in buckets, but he couldn't get enough of it. And that was that same attitude. And the enormous room, I mean, it's not a good experience to be in jail for 3 months. But he was fascinated by the characters he met there. You know, there was the guy who had painted Commodore Vanderbilt's horses, right? And there was a longshoreman, and there was a butcher. I mean, he brought that Cummings, how delightful attitude to that whole experience in a way that almost seems, I mean, when you read his letters home where he's telling them how he's having a ball, you think, because by the time he got out of there, he was pretty sick. You know, it's not a good way to live. But in the poems, a lot of them are very exultant and very, here's one. Oh, sweet spontaneous earth, how often have the prurient fingers of philosophers pinched and poked thee? Has the naughty thumb of science prodded thy beauty? Have religions taken thee across their scraggy knees and squeezed and buffeted thee that thou mightest conceive gods? But true only to the incomparable couch of thy rhythmic lover, death, thou answerest them only with spring. So that's very Cummings-esque, right? And I think most of the poetry has that, isn't this delightful, attitude. But he also got very, very angry. War made him very, very angry. He wrote some very, very angry poems about what Russia did in Hungary in 1956. You know, so there's anger, but a lot of them are pretty exuberant. Yeah.
Did he have any feelings, as many had after the First World War, that the Bolshevik Revolution was the beginning of something new?
Oh, what a question. Yeah, well, that's such a good question. We'll see if I can. So many people, many friends of Cummings, including John Reed, who had gone to Harvard with him and lived across the alley, thought that communism, that Lenin and Trotsky and Marx and Stalin were the answer, that capitalism was over and communism was what was going to save us all. And many of them had gone to Russia and come back, Lincoln Steffens. I've seen what does he say? I've seen the future and it is, and it works, exactly. I've seen the future and it works. So Cummings decided he should go to Russia. And he didn't get there till 1933. and he was allergic to authority. And so he saw right away what was happening in Russia before anybody else. And he got there, and there were these morons like Charles Henry Dana who were like, isn't this wonderful? You know, Stalin is a saint. Cummings could see that the people were terrified. You know, he was very sensitive to that, and he hated it. And Aimé is not a pro-communist book, quite the opposite. He became furiously anti-communist and thought Stalin was really a horrible, horrible man, which it turned out Cummings was right. But he got in a lot of trouble. People stopped talking to him. People crossed the street to avoid him. But yeah, he saw, partly because he was the kind of person who would see that the Bolshevik revolution was not working in the way it was advertised to be working, but also because he didn't get there till 33, when it really had stopped working. I think the purges had started. So, but good question. He died in 19... I always get this wrong. He died in 1960... Help me here. Oh, so when he was 67. Young. And, you know, in those days, he chain-smoked. He drank a lot. He took Donatol for his digestion. He took Nembutal to sleep. He took whatever they gave him. He had back problems, so he wore something that he called the Iron Maiden, that had been made for him by a doctor in Boston, which was a girdle that went from here to here. You know, and he died of a brain aneurysm. I mean, it just, yeah, yeah.
Another question. I understand he worked in the mailroom of Collier's magazine. What other kind of jobs like that did he have?
Well, he didn't work in the mailroom at Collier's magazine. He worked at, he thought it was going to be Collier's magazine. He was at Harvard. He knew he needed a job. And I think Amy Lowell helped him get that job. He was working in the mailroom at Collier's publishing house. And he said it was so boring that he was able to read both Eddas. You know what the Eddas are? That Scandinavian, endlessly boring Scandinavian, right? While he was working in the mailroom at Collier's publishing, he hated it. And he quit, and he never had another job like that again. But while he was at Collier's, well, Bill Cody died. And it's on a piece of Collier's memo paper. You can see he's writing, Buffalo Bill died to, you know, I mean, that poem starts while he's at Collier's, but he hated it and quit pretty quickly and never did that again. Sure, I can, and I'm happy to, because I feel as if I'm giving the poetry short shrift. So one of the things that's interesting about Cummings is that he's really a formalist. I think he's very misunderstood. He knew more about poetics than most people on earth, and he decided to twist the forms to make them more powerful, and twist them and twist them and twist them. So he wrote many Petrarchan sonnets, which you would never recognize as a Petrarchan sonnet. He wrote Sestinas, he wrote Villanelles, but he twisted them and twisted them to make them more powerful. And also he used upper and lowercase letters for emphasis. He switched out parts of speech. And the other, remember I said that he said that the source of his style was "Would you hit a lady with a baby," right? So the other source of his style was this incredible poem by Ezra Pound called "The Return," in which for the first time somebody used upper and lowercase as punctuation and space as punctuation. It's an extraordinary poem. It's actually in my book because it's so important. Pound was a tremendous influence on Cummings and everybody else, Eliot, Hemingway, everybody. And then they became friends, and Pound went through what he went through, and they stayed friends. Cummings, although he didn't have a lot of money, sent a check to St. Elizabeth's to help with Pound's care. And one of the nicest things in the book is the correspondence between Pound and Cummings when they were both old men. They got into a big fight about whether or not the blue jay is a good bird or a bad bird. And you know, Cummings quoted from Roger Torrey Peterson, and Pound said, you know, how can you go to a secondary source like that? I mean, it's a really lovely thing. So he was very influenced by Pound, especially by The Return, and then they stayed friends. But, you know, Cummings was, I think, the only American modernist. He really had this idea that was very much abroad in the 20s and 30s, that the old conventional ways of apprehending things, whether it was a poem or a picture of a barn, was not the most acute way to represent them, that it was much better. He was very influenced by the Armory Show of 1916, where he saw Duchamp's nude descending a staircase, so that whole idea of capturing motion through staccato on the page was something he did very much. In Buffalo Bill, you know, it's Buffalo Bill's defunct, who used to ride a water-smooth silver stallion and break clay pigeons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man, and what I want to know is, how do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death? But so the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just like that, that's that kind of Duchampian using language to create motion. The modernists had a whole bunch of ideas. Another one was that you could create sense with sound, and that was very much Gertrude Stein's game, right? So that instead of saying, you know, the word that represents the thing, I'm trying to think of an example. Well, water smooth silver stallion, right? So instead of saying he had a big horse, right, you say he had a water smooth silver stallion, and the sound of water smooth silver stallion gives you a sense of the speed of that horse that you would never get if he just said he had a very fast silver horse. So he was very much part of that whole thing. And I think, you know, when I was writing this, people would say, oh, he's the guy with the lowercase, you know. And he signed his name upper and lowercase, just like you and I do. He didn't want it to be a tricky thing. There's a whole other lecture I could give about the lowercase I, but he really knew what he was doing. There's nothing casual about the way he put words on the page. So maybe one more question from the, okay. Well, but Frost didn't mean that about Cummings because Cummings isn't writing free verse, you know. I mean, and the one good thing Frost said is that a poem like a piece of ice on a stove must ride on its own melting. So let's give Frost credit for saying something smart. I got in a big fight at Vanity Fair because they said, well, you know, Frost and Cummings were both educated men, and I'm like, no, no, no. Frost dropped in at Dartmouth, and then he dropped in at Harvard, and that doesn't constitute an education. So one more question, you think, you guys? Mark, Carol, one more question? Yeah.
Can you say just a little bit about the lowercase?
Oh, the lowercase I is so interesting. But here's how you think of it, or how I think of it. Like, you can ask yourself, am I a lowercase person or an uppercase person? Right? And Cummings was very much a lowercase I. And he kind of happened on it. You know, the handyman at Silver Lake only used lowercase. So he referred to himself as I. And then, of course, you find it in Greek in ways that I don't understand, because unlike Cummings, I'm not fluent in Greek. But Edward Cummings, Cummings' father, was very much an uppercase I, a Harvard professor, a Unitarian minister, uppercase I. And so the whole uppercase I versus lowercase I is almost, you can almost see the whole world through that contrast, you know. And the lowercase I is nimble, right? It's humble. It's attractive. It's, you know, it's all those things that the uppercase I, not so much, right? Exactly. It's Greenwich Village instead of Harvard. You know, Harvard is an uppercase H. More. It's gotten more uppercase as the years have gone by. So that's sort of the short version. Okay, thanks. Thanks for laughing.